So I want to read something to get us started this morning, and then we're going to do a two-minute meditation, and then we'll all say the prayer together. This is out of the Tao book again. It's called Prejudice. No mother thinks her child is ugly. No one is indifferent to themselves. We're all familiar with prejudice. It comes in many forms: nationalism, chauvinism, provincialism, racism. Many of us undoubtedly cry out against these injustices. As long as there is prejudice, we declare, we are never able to fairly know one another. And yet, it is exactly a type of prejudice that also keeps us from knowing ourselves. If we think about it, we ourselves are the ones we most favor. We cater to our bodily needs, our sensual indulgences, our intellectual curiosities, our lustful ambitions, and what we think the people in the world owe us. When we are sick or disadvantaged, no one feels our pain more or wails more loudly. When we are satisfied, no one rejoices with greater satisfaction. When we are on the verge of death, no one clings with such vehemence. As long as we are slaves to our appetites, then we cannot have the attention for spirituality. As long as we value comfort over effort, then we shall never have the fortitude for our spiritual quest. As long as we adhere to intellectual ideas over experience, then we can never have a genuine perspective of spirit. As long as we insist that we are separate individual entities apart from the rest of the universe, then we shall never realize the true oneness that permeates all of existence. No mother thinks her child ugly, because that child is her own creation. In the same way, we're inevitably partial to ourselves. We create ourselves. If we are to reach any sort of spiritual realization, we must confront and resolve this prejudice. 2 minute meditation.
Prayer.
God, please lay aside everything I think I know about this weekend, the big book, alcoholism, addiction, the 12 steps, myself, and especially you, God, so I may have an open mind and a new experience. Help me see the truth. Amen.
So this reading that I chose for this morning, you know, what really stuck out to me is this idea that recovery is about getting comfortable and feeling good. And if it's good, it must be from God. And if it's bad, it must be from the dark side. It must not be God. And I'll tell you guys, one of the belief systems that really had a negative impact on me in early recovery was this idea that If it feels good, it's good, and if it feels bad, it's bad. I'll tell you, the things that have created the most discomfort and have been the most painful have been for my highest good. They've actually taken me closer to God, and the things that have felt really good and been these accomplishments that I have patted myself on the back for and other people pat me on the back for have taken me further away from God. I'm always fascinated when people pick up their anniversary medallions and they get up there and somebody says, how'd you do it? And the reality of it for me is I didn't. I have very little to do with staying clean and sober. I seek to expand my conscious awareness of God, and the power keeps me sober. If you woke up today and made your number one priority staying clean and sober for the day, then you just made your number one priority something you can't accomplish. So it's about seeking that deeper, more meaningful experience with God. And if you're committed to that, I believe we're always safe and protected. But the longer I stay clean and sober, the more I realize that the struggles and the difficulties of life, they send me, and you're going to hear me talk about this several times over the weekend, they send me into a more sincere prayer life with my Creator. The fact that I can do some goofy things and do some insane things in recovery, which we will all do or have done, and still go to God to solve my problems means I am in fit spiritual condition, regardless of what the behavior is. Now, we live in a cultural framework called 12-step recovery where some people sometimes see behavior, oh, he's not in recovery. Yes and no, maybe. Both, you know, we always think it's either or, but what if it's both and? And so what I'm not giving you a green light to go do some insane shit outside today. That's not what's going on here. I'm giving you a new perspective to have when the insane stuff shows up for you. Okay? That's what I'm doing. Have that be an indicator of where growth has to take place, where you can really concentrate your communication with your God on these areas. Don't hide it, because it's going to happen. It happens to every single one of us in here. And so what I would invite you to do is to discuss it with other people, because I guarantee you all of us do goofy, insane stuff. And what's really cool is when someone's done it and they've overcome it and they can share their experience with you with how they did that. So that's why I chose that route.
I'm an alcoholic. My name's Brandon.
Brandon.
And got some new people here. So thanks for showing up. For those of you that are back, thank you. We spent last night talking kind of about a lot of general information, kind of setting the tone for this. We're doing some myth busting of some of the jingles and myths that we hear within the rooms. And kind of a disclaimer on what somebody came up and asked a question last night, and they want a clarification on one of the things that we said, which is awesome, because we can't capture our entire experience around everything we say, or you guys would be here forever and be completely more bored than you are now. But so if something doesn't quite sound right to you, come and ask us a question, because we're trying to capture the biggest possible part of this that we can, but there are always little tweaks and exceptions to what we say. But that needs to be figured out in a dialogue, because a lot of the time what is it's not what we said that's wrong, it's the way that you received it is from a different perspective, and once we can align our perspectives up, then we can get on the same page, and then what we said maybe makes more sense to you. So we talked about the circle and the triangle, and the importance of being grounded in all three sides. We talked about recovered versus recovering. Talked about what we recover from. We identified the difference between alcoholic and addict, and kind of the progression of the disease. We didn't say this last night, but I was thinking about it this morning in meditation, is that people assume that if somebody does drugs that they're automatically an addict. If that were the case, then everybody that drank alcohol must be an alcoholic, right? But clearly that's not the case, because there's plenty of people that drink alcohol that are not alcoholics. I'm married to one of them. She has her half a bottle of Mike's Hard Lemonade, and she's done. I don't know what that is, but it's not alcoholism. So just because drugs are in your story doesn't automatically make you an addict. But so many people think that that's, well, I smoked a lot of pot. Well, that doesn't mean anything. It means you smoked a lot of pot. So, you know, look at your own experience. Now we're going to dive into the doctor's opinion and probably shake out a couple more of these myths that we've gotten into. So with that, why don't you fire off?
You want to fire off?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's turn to doctor's opinion, XXVI. Who sitting in this room right now has a great deal of guilt and shame around your addiction and when you were in the mix, up in the mix, on a spree, you did some pretty heinous stuff to some people that care about you and you care about them, and you just can't shake it. Okay. What I'm about to share with you is going to immediately get you free of this if you can really line your perspective up with mine around what it truly means to be powerless. Let's go down to the third full paragraph on page XXVI. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol and drugs interests us. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little. But as ex-problem drinkers and drug users, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which I could not otherwise account for. So, in 2005, I'm out in Las Vegas. I'm on a spree. I'm out there for 5 days. I don't sleep the entire time I'm there. I miss a few flights trying to get back to Atlanta. We roll back into Atlanta, and I'm the craving. You know, everyone sitting here in this room right now is craving something, and you don't even know it. The only way you would know it is if I came up behind you and put a plastic bag over your head. You're craving oxygen, and when it's cut off, you will fight tooth and nail for it. And so I get back to my house, and my girlfriend and I are trying to figure out how to get more money so we can go get some more drugs. And my mom hadn't seen me in a while, and I'd vanished. I wasn't returning phone calls or anything. And I'm in the middle of that craving's on me. I want more. The monster has been awakened. The fire inside is burning strong. And the thing is, when the monster wakes up and the fire turns on, monster goes away when monster wants to go away. Fire goes out when fire wants to go out. I don't have any say in it. It always chewed me up, and it spit me out when it wanted to spit me out. That's the abnormal physical reaction. We break out in this phenomenon of craving. I want more, and I'll do anything I can, and we'll do anything to anyone that tries to get in the way of me getting more. So my mom comes to the house, and we're in the process of going back downtown, and she tries to cut off the craving, and I grab a Dirt Devil vacuum cleaner, and I threw it at her as hard as I could and told her to get the fuck out of my house. That really messed with me in early recovery, until I was sitting at a big book study one night and I read this paragraph. And you guys got to listen very closely. Whatever behaviors you engage in when you're in the midst of a spree, in the grips of the physical craving, you could not have done any different. You are not responsible. But when you go make amends in the ninth step, you can't tell the person you're making amends to any of this. They don't want to hear that shit. My mom didn't want to hear, Mom, the reason I threw that Dirt Devil vacuum cleaner at you was because I did some drugs and I activated the phenomenon of craving, and therefore I was not responsible for any of the actions that I engaged in after that. That's not what my mom wanted to hear in my amends. She wanted me to admit how I was wrong, how I regretted what I had done and how I had harmed her, and I needed her to know if she wanted to talk about it that I would listen. And I asked her if I'd left anything out. Now, there was a whole host of things I'd listed off to her in my amends. And then I asked, what can I do to make it right? Because the people closest to us, all they care about is clean time and new behavior. That's it. Clean time, new behavior. But I got free. I got free. I was no longer filled with any shame or guilt because I knew I couldn't have done any different. And we are so covered up with this guilt and shame because inside our mind tells us I could have done different. Well, then you've misunderstood the powerlessness around the physical craving. Because that what that says is, no, you couldn't have done any different. You had your head in the tiger's mouth, and that shit was taking you wherever it was taking you. So you can get free of this. You don't have to pay a therapist any more money for it. Okay? If you truly get this, if you get this. Yeah, I got it. I regret a lot of things. But I can't say that I have any guilt and shame around. And I did a lot of other heinous stuff. That's just the example I'm using this morning. So about 2 years ago, about a year and 9 months ago, I pick up a buddy at the ER. And this is a guy I've sponsored on 3 separate occasions over the last 8 years. He's become a dear friend of mine. I mean, successful business gone. $500,000 home gone. The beautiful wife gone. 3 kids gone. Can't stay clean, can't stop smoking crack. And I pick him up, and he's sitting in the passenger seat of my car, and he's like, God, and he's like, you know, he's been up for days, and he had busted his head open, and he was twitching and tweaking, and he's like, I can't believe I keep choosing this stuff over my kids. And I turned to him, I said, brother, you have completely misunderstood this first step, man. These runs you go on where you disappear and you do all these crazy things, that's what you're going to do when your head's in the tiger's mouth and you're in that physical craving. And he is riddled with guilt and shame. He's never been able to get free of it because he thinks he could have done different. And it just follows him. So I invite you guys to explore this concept. You will get free of a lot.
And a lot of people want to carry that into recovery. Like, well, and this is, I hear this all the time. Well, what do you expect? I'm an alcoholic. That's hiding behind the disease when the disease is not activated within you. The physical component is not activated within you. We'll probably talk about it again later on, but it's... I am responsible for my life today. If I'm acting like an asshole, it's not because of alcoholism. It's because I'm an asshole. And I can't just say... Well, what do you expect? You know, that's how it is. And so what Tarek's talking about is when you're in the grips of the physical craving, okay, don't confuse the two of them. Because when you're not in the grips of it, you are 100% responsible for what's going on in your life.
You're still responsible to repair the damage you've caused.
Absolutely.
That's the important thing here. The reason I teach this way is because addicts and alcoholics suffer from a great deal of shame and guilt because they believe they could have done different. And it's misunderstanding the first step. True powerlessness. You know, that means you don't have any power to do any different.
So on page 18, kind of ties into this too, is it says an illness of this sort, talking about drug addiction and alcoholism, and we have come to believe it is an illness, involves those about us in a way no other human sickness can. If a person has cancer, all are sorry for him, and no one is angry or hurt. But not so with the alcoholic or addict illness. For with there it goes annihilation of all things worthwhile in life. It engulfs all whose lives touch the sufferers. It brings misunderstanding. Anybody got any of that? Fierce resentment? Financial insecurity, anybody? Disgusted friends and employers, warped lives of blameless children, sad wives and parents, anyone can increase the list. And that paragraph to me is so important, and it ties into this phenomenon of craving, because I can't tell you how many times I get to that paragraph when I'm sitting down with the sponsee, and he gets angry at me because he knows somebody that has had cancer. And he's like, you can't call alcoholism and cancer the same thing. And so in this person's mind, they don't look at this as an illness. They don't look at it as something that's beyond their own control. They look at it as a choice. And whenever I get to that paragraph 18 and somebody's still wrapped up in saying that cancer sufferers and alcoholics and addicts, that's not the same thing, they still think that they choose to do these things. They still think that they have made a choice to drink. They still think that they made a choice to go smoke crack. That they were driven to go do those things. And if you really get clear on your experience, you will see that you had no choice whatsoever, that you were driven to do those things. That's why we spent that time talking about our drug of no choice, our master. You know, what is your master? What took you to the places that you didn't go? You did what it said. You went where it said. You spent whatever money you didn't have whenever it told you that it needed it. Where's the choice in that, guys? Where's the choice?
Once you wake up to this concept and you internalize this concept, hopefully you'll find yourself placed in a position where you're going to be willing to do whatever you have to do to never be in that position again. So the behavior associated with it has become unacceptable. You will not hear Brandon and I talk much about this concept of acceptance. I, for one, think it's a worthless concept. Why? Because I don't tell guys to accept being powerless. I show them the helplessness of their first step, and I ask them, is existing in that way acceptable to you? I want it to be unacceptable. Because from a place of being unacceptable, we muster more willingness than ever to never be in that position again. Living that way of life is unacceptable. I talk very little about accepting my powerlessness, although I see my utter powerlessness. But acceptance is almost like an excuse not to do anything, right? I sit around. People hide behind the concept of God's will sometimes. If it's God's will, then I'll get a job. I'm just going to sit here and wait for God to bring me the job that I'm entitled to have. Yeah. Right? So, you know, some people think I'm a heretic because I don't ever refer to this concept. But I just think when things become unacceptable, we begin to muster a great deal of willingness to do things never to be in those positions again. And that's what it's about.
Good question. What you said, I have family members that are highly religious, Christian. I was raised in it. They have told me before, time and time again, it's sin. It's not, you have a choice.
That's their experience, not yours.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, everybody has their own experience. So on the way home, Joe Alvarez called me, and he's like, "So you and Tarek are doing the wall this weekend?" And I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "Oh, I can just see you up there reading page 417 to everybody." We had a great laugh. And this buddy of ours also doesn't necessarily believe that acceptance is the answer to all our problems. So he and I have a back and forth joke that we like to share about it whenever we experience it. So, anyway.
You want to do next one?
You're doing great.
Okay. Turn page in the doctor's opinion. One of my favorite paragraphs in the book. Tarek and Brandon drink. I'm at the bottom of the page. Tarek and Brandon drink and use drugs essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol and drugs. This effect or sensation is so elusive, very difficult to hold on to, that while Tarek and Brandon both admit that it's hurting them or injurious, Tarek and Brandon, after a time, cannot differentiate the true from the false. We reach a point where Tarek and Brandon can't tell the difference between what drugs and alcohol are doing for them and what drugs and alcohol are doing to them. But they've been doing it for so long that it's the only life they know. It is a normal one. Tarek and Brandon are uneasy or restless, irritable or easily annoyed, and never satisfied or discontented unless Tarek and Brandon can again experience that sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by just taking a few drinks, a few lines, one blast off to Crackstone. Alcohol and drugs which they see others taking with impunity, without consequences. After Tarek and Brandon give in or succumb to the desire again, the phenomenon of craving develops, the monster wakes up, the fire within is activated, and they pass through the well-known stages of a spree or a run. And Tarek spends a few days in a crack hotel, emerging remorseful about after 3 or 4 days. He looks in the mirror, the tears come, he calls himself a piece of shit, and he says he's fucking done with this insanity. And he makes a firm resolution not to smoke crack again. And then he repeats it over and over. And unless Tarek can experience an entire psychic change, which is a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from addiction, there is very little hope for Tarek's recovery. That's the way I've learned how to personalize this book as I read it. It makes the book come alive, and I invite you to start working that way. The book's a textbook. You can do a lot of things with a textbook. And so I had... Not everybody that smokes crack, believe it or not, is a drug addict. I'm going to tell you guys a story. So I find my alcoholism, and when I used to go to bars and tell myself I was going to have a few drinks, I could not control the amount I drank. I would always be more visibly intoxicated out of the group of us. 10 of us go to the bar. Everybody knows when Tarek's crossed the line. Okay, that's just the kind of drinker I was. And I'm at the bar with my buddies, and we've overshot the mark, and we immediately want some cocaine. And so we couldn't find any powder this one night, so I was like, look, I can go see my boy downtown. Just pull our money together. So I go downtown. I get three slabs, $300 worth of crack. We roll back to my house. And it's interesting, man. I see it as it like it's happening right now. We're sitting in around the coffee table. There's a big pile of crack in the middle of the coffee table. My two friends are like socializing. And all that exists for me is this pile of crack on the table, right? Yes. And I am puffing strong. And so by 4 or 5 in the morning, we're out of crack. And I want more crack.
Yeah.
And they don't want more crack. Yeah. They've got some Crown, they've got some pot, and they've got some Valium, and they just want to chill out and listen to music. And I started slamming alcohol, pacing around the house, trying to convince them to give me more money. And they say no. And then I got in my car and drove downtown, and I stayed downtown for a few days smoking crack. The effect produced in them was quite different than the effect produced in me. And you know what the greatest delusion for those last few years was? Is I had friends that could rage on Friday and Saturday night and sleep all day Sunday and go to work on Monday. I wanted that so bad. That was the delusion that drove me to the gates of insanity and almost death, was the idea that I was going to be a weekend warrior, that I was going to be a recreational crack smoker. It did not exist for me.
Smoke crack like a gentleman?
Yeah. And guys, I don't know about you guys, but maybe you have some of that in your experience. You got these people that were really close to you that rage, and you want it so bad. And the only thing that snuffed out the last flicker of conviction that I could do the job of my own was my experience with utter powerlessness, that I could not do any different. Right? I got to a place where I never thought the next time was going to be different. As long as you think the next time is going to be a little bit different, you've got a sliver of hope. I finally reached a place where I knew the next time was going to be like the last time. And then I couldn't do any different, and that was the most baffling feature of it. I couldn't stay away from it and where it took me once I started.
So when Tarek tells his stories, now we don't all, not all of us know what slabs are, can see the pile on thing, but so I got to translate that story into my experience. My experience is fire pits going on, fridge full of beer, and people are starting to leave. And I'm trying, no, guys, come on, stay. And man, I got to get up tomorrow. Like, my kid's got a, you know, soccer game or something like that. And I'm like, no, you can still stay here and go do that. You know, it's like that's when the fire's ignited in me, as I'm doing that, right? So translate what we're saying into your experience, just like Tarek did with the book. If, especially when you're sponsoring a guy through this book and you're taking him through the steps, if you can't make this a personal experience, you're not going to hook up with the person. Change their names. Put their name in the book. Put your name in the book. Change it around like he did, where you deconstruct the words, or you change the words to make it make more sense for you. If it makes more sense for you, it might make more sense for somebody else. And then all of a sudden, you're starting to really hook up with the other person, and their experience comes alive for them. They can actually remember being in that experience. And that's a lot of what you'll see us do. There are question marks all through this book, even though there's not question marks there. There's questions on every page in this book. They look like statements because they have periods at the end of them. But if you change it just slightly to your own experience, did that ever happen to you? You've heard me do it already. Like when I was going through the thing on page 18, when we were going through the thing in Two Wives talking about type 1 through 4. Did that happen to you? Do you have experience with that? What, you know, make this thing come alive, or you're not going to hook up with it.
Mm. And this is why I love doing these with Brandon, because we get both sides of the coin. And hopefully you guys are working with this idea that you're looking for similarities and not the differences, because the mind will hold on to differences. And so if you need us to rephrase something, just ask us.
Because maybe you haven't smoked anything out of a light bulb recently.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Or a potato. Or so, some of those other things.
So not being able to differentiate between the true and the false, I just gave you guys an example. What was it for me was this idea that I could be a recreational drug user, that I saw it in my friends and they could be true for me, but it was false. You know, another common one for me was the idea that I could just go have a few drinks. You know, I can't tell you the number of times I'm sitting in my office, guys at the office, let's go get a happy hour at the bar. I get to the bar, I start drinking, I'm Budweiser shot, 7 o'clock, they're all going home, I'm just getting started. That's where I find my alcoholism. I did not drink the same way the guys I worked with at the office drank. And then they talk about this concept of restless, irritable, and discontent. I don't like the words because they're thrown around the rooms very often, and they lose impact. But when I use the words uneasy, easily annoyed, and never satisfied, I can really identify with that. That's the internal condition that has to be addressed. That's the breeding ground for the mental obsession. I did drugs and alcohol. Drugs and alcohol did what they did to me because way back when they did a lot for me. Okay, it was a source of power when drugs and alcohol were working. I didn't regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it when drugs and alcohol were working. I could comprehend the word peace, and I knew serenity when alcohol and drugs were working. I knew happiness. I didn't care about my money problems when alcohol and drugs were working. I get to the bar, I get a nice buzz on, buy everybody a damn drink, right?
When did all these nice people get here?
I don't know.
What were those three words again? Uneasy, unsatisfied, and what?
Uneasy, easily annoyed, and never satisfied. That's it. If that's working on you, that's like a spring tightening in your chest. And eventually it's going to get so tight that you're going to have relief. And if you're not getting ease and comfort from this 12-step process, your mind will take you back to what once gave you ease and comfort. And it will conveniently forget what happens to you when you try to use drugs and alcohol. So, the best way to see your physical cravings at the bottom of page XXIX. So when I'm taking a guy through the steps, we're going to talk about this. I don't hold true with those who believe that addiction and alcoholism are entirely problems of mental control. I've had many men who I've worked with, for example, taking them through the steps. We talk about some problem or important engagement or business deal which was to be settled on a certain date in their favor. They take a drink or a hit of crack cocaine or a stick of syringe in their arm a day or so prior to the date where that event was going to be settled favorably to them. They activate the phenomenon of craving. They wake up the monster. The fire turns on, and at once it becomes paramount to all other interests, so that important appointment was not met. These men are not drinking or using drugs to escape. They're drinking and using drugs to overcome a craving beyond the mental control. Now, when you mentally, before you ever put the substance in your body, there may be some escape there. But once you activate the beast, there's no escape. You're trying to feed something, or it's feeding on itself. And so for me, you know, getting to work in the morning sober was an important engagement to keep. And I rarely kept it. Showing up to holiday functions where your mom specifically says, do not get intoxicated at Thanksgiving. And then you start drinking and you get intoxicated visibly at Thanksgiving. You know, telling my family I'll meet them at the restaurant for dinner. And not showing up at the restaurant for dinner. Okay.
We had just moved into a new house. And family members from all over the place were coming to have Thanksgiving at our house. Okay. And my sister and brother-in-law had to go to another Thanksgiving at a certain time. So we had to eat our Thanksgiving dinner at a very specific time. I don't know if any of you guys know this, but it takes a little while to cook a turkey. So my job, my only job Thanksgiving morning was to press the button on the oven to turn it on. That's it. That's all I had to do, right? And, well, you know, Wednesday night before Thanksgiving, Brandon decided to have a little party for himself, right? And so I am sitting there. I wake up sometime 7. I had to wake up at like, it was like 5 o'clock. I had to wake up to turn the oven on, right? I wake up in the basement at like 7:30, 8 o'clock with like 4 alarms going off and my wife standing over me just wearing me out, screaming at me. You've ruined Thanksgiving. You're like her parents, my parents, brothers, sisters, everybody's coming to our house, and they're coming very specifically at this time so that we can have Thanksgiving dinner, and Brandon's only job was to turn on the oven. But what happened Wednesday night is that that fire got ignited, and I couldn't stop, and although I had 10 alarms set, and I probably passed out somewhere around 3 or 4 o'clock because I'm sure the logic was, well, I'll just stay up and then turn it on and then sleep after that, right? That's probably the logic I used.
Yeah.
But something happened, right? Something beyond my control. Brandon's gone. Wife gets up, does whatever she's doing in the morning, walks in the kitchen, sees that the oven's not on. She probably was yelling at me for 20 minutes before I came to, right? So, again, a craving beyond my control, right? And my job was a simple one, nothing major. But that's how it shows up. You got to look at your own experience. Where did these things show up in your life?
So psychic change. What does that mean?
When do we hit like who drank on good days and bad days?
You can hit it now. We did it last night though.
Did we?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we did the trigger. Yeah. Psychic change in what I've experienced in 10 years involves my first psychic change was really believing that the 12-step process was going to save my life. That's a new way of thinking, right? A new psychic change was that going to these meetings on a regular basis was going to be a very important part of my life. Another psychic change that every trouble I ever have in life is of my own making. I am never to be the assigner of blame. I surround myself with men and women who immediately remove me from victimhood. I don't exist in victimhood. I cannot. My life depends on it. I must be responsible for my life. I must have a perspective on how this life gets lived. Although I do experience the human powerlessness at times, it leads to insanity and some goofy behavior. So, I mean, what is a psychic change to you guys? Early recovery, my psychic change was when I'd handled a situation unlike a way I'd handled it before. You know, a common one in early recovery was, you know, my parents wouldn't give me money like they used to, and I would be okay with it from time to time. All right? They said no. It took my mom 5 years to trust me. 5 years. Every day she called me or tried to text me or contact me in some way. And I remember I'd go to my first sponsor, Randy, and I'd be like, man, dude, my mom, she's driving me crazy. Like, she calls to see if I'm okay every single day. And he goes, well, how long did you terrorize her and rob her of emotional security? He'd say, Terry, you do understand if you walk 20 miles into a dark, ugly forest, you can't just turn around and walk out.
Yeah.
You can't. And so these were like psychic changes for me in early recovery. It doesn't have to be in the what's the back of the book say, sudden and spectacular upheavals. And that immediate changes in feeling and outlook, although those things do happen to us on a regular basis, look for the little subtle changes in the way you think. That's the start of a psychic change. You want to talk about your ideals, Grounded?
You keep going. I'll just keep interjecting.
Okay. All right, we're going to wrap up the doctor's opinion real quick. Go to XXVIII for me. It's the frothy emotional appeal paragraph that everybody talks about. XXVIII. It's Roman numeral 28. So frothy emotional appeal, we all know that what that is, right? Everybody know what frothy emotional appeal is?
No.
Don't drink for her. Don't drink no matter what. You can do it. You're worth it. No. That's what it's.
I don't know what it means.
It's anything that somebody says that is a slogan or a jingle that sounds logical and feasible, but doesn't work for shit.
And it doesn't always have to be a jingle though, because my boy who I was talking about earlier, his wife with those three little kids, be like, we'll call him as Joe, but his name's not Joe. She would be like, Joe, will you quit doing this? You're destroying the kid's life. For your own kids, stop.
Frothy emotional appeal.
That's frothy emotional appeal. So
yeah, sometimes it doesn't even come across in a positive. Sometimes it comes across in, I'm going to leave your ass if you don't stop drinking. That's frothy emotional appeal.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't work for me. In fact, it didn't work until she did leave.
Yeah, you're going to have to tell that story at some point.
Mm-hmm.
So the Tarek and Brandon's message interests and holds you today because we have depth and weight. I think we have won your confidence because we share similar experiences to you, and we somehow haven't done these crazy things we're talking about in a very long time. So we have a solution in our lives that works. That's why we have depth and weight. So in all cases, and this is a very important question, do you believe your ideals must be grounded in a power greater than yourself if you are to recreate your life in this new relationship with God? What does that mean, to have your ideals grounded in a power greater than yourself? I ask you to reflect on that question. We're probably going to touch on it as the weekend unfolds, but it's important. It's another one of those things that gets said in meetings a lot. Well, what do we mean by that? What does it mean to you to live a life where your ideals are grounded in a power greater than yourself? What does it mean to you?
Because we'll touch on it again and again and again over the weekend. The question that was asked on the first day is, are you guys going to talk about the fourth dimension and the sixth sense, and what does that look like? And, you know, the book talks about God consciousness, connection with that. You want to really get hooked up and really have a life that is just stupid good, get a connection, a relationship with whatever this power is. Now, 2 weeks prior, the 2 weeks prior to this week, I do construction inspections all through the Carolinas, and I had more inspections than I thought was humanly possible to get done and write the reports and do all this stuff. But I sat down, looked, I'd said some prayers around, all right, God, see all this stuff I got to have done. it doesn't look like it's possible. You know, come with me, let's go, right? And for two straight, like the first week was impossible to accomplish with my thinking mind, right? Mm. Got through it. Got them all done. Got them all the reports written. The next week, like literally as I'm driving around the Carolinas on Thursday and Friday, inspection requests started coming in for the next week. And I'm just like, holy crap. Like, next week's going to look like this week. And it did. 21 the first week, 19 the second week, okay? And when I say all through the Carolinas, we're talking like the I covered 1,000 miles at least in 1 week, right? And I was hooked up to that power the entire time, directing me and telling me what to do. This week started. I really had nothing going on Monday, but I kind of had started kind of working in directions where my intuitive thought took me. All of a sudden, my week filled up, and I was incredibly efficient such that I showed up here at 4:15. I really didn't know how I was going to get here on time, but trusted that that was going to happen. And so what happens, it talks about then if we are to recreate our lives. Co-creating with that power that's working in your life is the coolest thing that you could possibly ever imagine. And it's going to look like nothing that you thought it would look. If you look at your life a year ago versus now, it's going to look drastically different than you thought it would. My life, I lived in a 5-bedroom home. Had a wife, 2 kids. Drove a car that I didn't buy it new, but knew was worth about $80,000. Had the special title after my name with the job and everything else. And now I live in a double-wide trailer in the middle of nowhere. We got goats and chickens and pigs and little rogue pigs this morning that were breaking out of their thing and running around the yard. Funniest thing that you've ever seen. Got to experience it sometime. And if you would have told me even 3 years ago that that's what my life would look like today, my question would be why? Why would that be my life? But today it's like the most fascinating, entertaining life I could ever hope for, and it keeps getting cooler and cooler. But it's that co-creation with this power that the doctor's opinion talks about in recreating your life. It's working with vision and intent. The things that are in the 11th step that nobody in the rooms talks about. Getting to create a vision for your future so that your future shows up the way that you want. We got to place orders, guys. We got to place orders with the universe of this is what I want out of my life. Now, here's the deal. I can't do that until my mind's been clean. Because if I use my mind in early sobriety to want to create this future, it's going to involve strip clubs and lots of money and endless supplies of alcohol. Like, that's what my life's, maybe we'll try some other stuff that we haven't tried before, right? Because that's what my mind, when in early recovery, tells me I want. After I go through the process of the steps and I clean the mind, I think that the governors are removed a little bit from our will, and spirit world starts working with you and saying, you know what, you look like you're headed in the right direction, and you're not going to use this power of co-creation for bad, so we can release some of the power to you. Mm. Ken, you got a question?
I talked to Brandon Thursday on the phone about 3 o'clock. I asked him, hey, what are you doing? Somewhere in North Carolina, and I got to go here, and then I'll be at this meeting Friday afternoon. I was like, Brandon, what about sleep? It's incredible.
And my answer was, it'll happen somewhere in there, I just don't know when, right?
Yeah.
Because that's working with the power, guys. That's literally, if you have conversations with me over the course of the week, it sounds a lot like a person who really has no idea what they're doing, because I don't really know what I'm doing. I'm following that power.
it sounds like you're talking to a guy who's lost his mind. And the really cool thing is he truly has lost his mind.
Isn't it?
That's what spirituality is about, losing your mind.
Isn't it sometimes, what did I say, hungry, tired, angry? Or,
oh, God.
Yeah.
Is it a nerve? Or,
no, it's no. Just, that'll be a tangent we'll go on to for too long. We can talk about it afterwards. Okay. Right. But so,
is that
when you enter the world of the spirit, the rest of the world will think that you've kind of cooped out a little bit. I know a lot of you guys, I see your faces, a lot of you guys are going, what the fuck is this guy talking about? But wouldn't it be cool to find out? Wouldn't it be cool to come on this ride where, like, have you guys ever, like, movie you've never seen before? Do you guys, like, go and watch the end real fast and then go back and watch the beginning? I mean, why would you do that? That would kind of, like, ruin the point of watching the movie, right? If you knew how it ended, especially if it's a movie like The Usual Suspects or something like that, where you get to the end and there's, like, this twist that you're like, what?
Yeah.
Well, why do we want that out of our life? Why do we want to know what the end game looks like? Why do we want to know exactly how life is going to be and then think that that's actually going to be satisfying in any way, shape, or form? Why not take the ride a little bit? Because the experience is the experience. Mills talked about it last night. It's not about, like, accomplishing the things that you wanted to accomplish. He said he got all those things that he wanted, and then he realized that that wasn't what he really needed. It was the ride of getting to that place. You want to experience God? Go with the ride. See how some of these crazy things show up in your life.
And you won't need to find answers anymore because the questions will disappear.
Poof.
I gotta say something about the hungry, angry, lonely, tired. Asking an individual, a man or a woman, not to experience hunger, anger, loneliness, and tiredness is like asking someone not to have a human experience. It's coming for you. There's nothing you can do about it. I have been hungry, angry, lonely, and tired to the nth degree just in the past 2 weeks, right? It's when they try to teach you to stay away from being hungry, angry, lonely, and tired, they're trying to teach you self-reliance. And if the big book is true, self-reliance always fails. Eventually, it will fail us. But you go hungry for a while and experience some loneliness and being tired, and you're spiritually fit where you're going into your relationship with God to move you through that experience, it will deepen the experience with God. But we live in a culture, this is the one thing I'm starting to, I get it's a program of action, but sometimes I wish there was no action. Just sit with the experience so it becomes, you can move through it. Right, we're always taught if you feel bad, start doing. Go to more meetings, call sponsees, do this, do that. Sometimes just is surrendering to the experience, be still and move through it. Your relationship with your Creator will move you through that experience, and then you'll be able to share that experience with other people. It's not always about doing. We're always in the business of being and becoming. You know, that's what our culture teaches us. You get, be this, be that, become this, become that. Sometimes just don't do anything.
2 years ago, I did a 5-day fast where I consumed nothing but water.
I remember that.
You think I was hungry?
Yeah.
Yeah. You want to see insanity settle in a little bit? It's about day 3.5, okay? You start getting those. Yeah, I was texting with Tarek and another buddy of mine. I'm like, okay, I think I've gone insane. But here's the deal, is that through that experience, just like Tarek was saying, what happened is the caveman, hunter-gatherer mind takes over, right? And so our body kind of starts shutting down non-vital functions, and it raises your senses. Your hearing is intensified. Your smell is intensified. Your vision is intensified. Your intuitive nature is increased to a level that you cannot comprehend. Aboriginal people that are looked upon by our society as non-sophisticated, these guys exist in that state. all of those senses get heightened because the hunter-gatherer needed to be more aware so that they could hear, smell, and see their food. They could sense their food so that they could go in, get their food, and go and have that experience. We got the same essential bodies that those people did back then. So what ended up happening, now I'm not saying do a five-day fast because I'm not going to do another one for unless I'm called to do it, because it was a kind of nerve-wracking, insane experience. But as a result of that experience, I got this thing that I'm telling you about that you can't have unless you try it. So loneliness has driven me to look at why nobody wants to be around me. Tired, I mean, like, some of these are so simple. I was going to a shrink in early sobriety because, you know, I wanted to kill myself, thought it might be a good idea. And I was talking about how I was getting up early in the morning and, like, I was halfway asleep through my entire workout, and I was trying coffee and I was trying to eat meals. I was trying all these things to try to be more awake. And then she asks this insane question of, have you ever considered going to bed earlier? And that was, I mean, it was like, when she said that, I like looked at her like, huh. But those were experiences, right? And so I can't avoid those. In fact, some of those take me to a place of learning that's deeper than anything I could hope for. So mm-hmm. This idea of stay away from it, I just don't get down with it.
And I mean, if what we do here is truly at the end of it about seeking a personal relationship with a power greater than yourself, how can you ever be alone if you're in that relationship? That's why, I mentioned last night I was stripped of my husbandhood, stripped of my fatherhood, all these things, because they're gone. They're not in my life on a regular basis anymore. And I was extremely alone. And I'm living by myself after being in a family unit for 7 years. It's interesting. So yeah, I've experienced intense loneliness. But it's driven me deeper into my relationship with God. So the more I'm stripped of, the more loss I experience, the deeper my connection with God. Go figure that. We're going to take a 15-minute break, guys.